Hi, Richard Feidler here. Thanks for downloading this Conversations podcast. There are many, many more at abc.net.au/conversations.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Hello and welcome to Conversations. When you stare at the night sky, it all looks very lovely. But as you try to take in the scale of the planets and the stars and the galaxies, the meter goes right off the scale. Events in the cosmos are incomprehensibly big or unfathomably hot or fast-moving or incredibly ancient. This is what we're told. There are exploding stars, clusters of galaxies with black holes at their centre that boom out bass notes into space. And there's even, as we now know, a planet made of diamonds. And it's that very extremeness, if you like, that fascinates my guest for you today. Professor Brian Gaensler is a former Young Australian of the Year. He's an internationally renowned astronomer who specialised in dying stars, interstellar magnets and cosmic explosions. The man is still under 40. He's written a book called Extreme Cosmos. Brian Gaensler, welcome to Conversations.
Thanks for having me, Richard.
One thing I got from reading your book is, well, of course, how extreme things are in the night sky, but ultimately how benign things are on Earth, how unextreme and mild the Earth is. What's that contrast like for you?
I find it quite comforting, actually, that, you know, no matter how aggressive or harmful we are on Earth, ultimately the universe isn't too fussed and it won't be affected. The stars will keep doing their things, living, dying, shining, no matter how we mess up this planet.
It's a bit of a flip around on what was thought for thousands of years, isn't it? That it was the Earth that was catastrophic, but space that was unchanging and benign.
Yeah, so many of the constellations and names of stars we have are Greek or Egyptian names because the constellations haven't changed for thousands of years. So if you're just a casual observer, you'd think that the night sky is this peaceful, tranquil place that never changes. But once you look through your telescope, you discover that the universe is very violent. There are explosions, collisions, all sorts of catastrophes all over the place all the time.
Can you remember as a child looking up at the stars and thinking, I want to know what's going on up there?
I very much can. I was a child that hated being bored. I was a sort of child that would look with despair when I only had 5 pages to go in my book because that would be the end and I'd have to think of something else to do. So as soon as I realised that the universe was essentially a book that never ends, I decided that this is where I wanted to spend my time when I grew up, that I would never have to worry about being bored, that every time you answer one question, you open up another 10 problems to tackle.
You've got a caricature of yourself, a cartoon that you got done, and you had an interesting conversation with a cartoonist. Tell me about what was the story behind that little cartoon.
So this would have been when I was probably 5 or 6 years old. The Easter Show or some other local show where you always have an artist will say, I'll draw a cartoon or a caricature of you for $5. I begged Mum and Dad if they could put down the money. I sat down next to the artist and she asked me, you know, what do you want to be when you grow up? Thinking that I'd probably say a firefighter or a police officer or something like that. And I said, without hesitation, I want to be an astronomer. I think she was a bit taken aback by that, but I still have this cartoon of myself as a 5 or 6-year-old peering through a telescope at the night sky. So it's a great reminder that I'm doing what I always wanted to do.
Yeah, I always see astronomers as people who have been clever enough to sustain a childlike wonder at the night sky. That's you, isn't it, Brian?
That is very much me. And when I became a professional astronomer, I thought that I would be surrounded by other people who, like me, had owned a telescope since the age of 5. And while there are some astronomers like that, there's just as many astronomers who couldn't point out a constellation to save their lives and who came at it from a very different angle, like that they liked computer programming or they liked mathematics, and they discovered astronomy as a great way of chasing that particular interest.
About 20 years ago or so, or 30 years ago, astrophysicists like Stephen Hawking were saying that we were approaching a theory of everything, a grand unified theory, which would pretty much explain the whole universe. Now that seems to be further away than ever. Does that please you?
It does and it doesn't. Ultimately, you have to hope that the universe is understandable. If you think there are some things that we can never figure out, then you sort of quickly come to the conclusion that there's just no point even trying. So you want the universe to be understandable in our lifetimes. On the other hand, just the name theory of everything just sort of suggests that there's nothing really much more to say after that. Fortunately, the devil is in the details. And even though we understand gas and gravity and stars, the different ways in which these different things can manifest themselves is so complicated that even once we have a theory of everything, just understanding how that theory is put into practice is lifetimes of work in itself.
We're these highly evolved apes that live in a 3D world because it's very practical for us to do so. What do you think about that? There's something about our very nature as animals, as human beings, that constrains us from really getting the nature of the cosmos.
Yeah, that's something that I worry about. We were not designed. I use the word design very cautiously, whether you think there was a designer or not. But our everything about us doesn't position us to think about galaxies or stars or cosmology. We weren't designed to do that. So the fact that we've made such incredible progress is just astonishing. But you've got to wonder, ultimately, we might find something where the brain power or the computing power needed to understand it is just beyond us. And that hasn't happened yet, but there are big problems right now. You know, we don't know what 95% of the universe is made of, and we've been stuck on these problems for a long time. So the breakthrough might be just around the corner, or it might be one of these things that humanity just lacks the insight to solve.
Yeah. I suppose the flip side of that is that even though we're not hugely well equipped to understand the real nature of things, like 10 dimensions in the universe and the like, we still do. And we've constructed these telescopes that can take pictures of distant galaxies. We're still able to do this, nonetheless. We're still that curious.
Yeah, and this ties into this. So two conflicting aspects of human curiosity. One is that we want to understand the universe, but then there's also this much more sort of aggressive territorial aspect that we want to sort of own things. We want to go to things and stick our flags on them and scoop a piece up and put it back here somewhere. So I guess there's a bit of contention within the space and astronomy community as to whether our money is best spent building bigger telescopes to look at more distant galaxies and stars, or whether we should be trying to go to the moon and go to Mars.
What do you think?
Well, I wouldn't say that my opinion is shared by everyone, but I really think that human spaceflight was a feel-good episode for the Cold War, and I think really our place is here. It's just too dangerous and too expensive, and we can learn and discover so much more just by looking through telescopes and building clever robots and space probes to explore the rest of the universe.
Brian, what was the name of this textbook you wrote as a kid for your school library? What was the name of it?
I don't think it ever had a name, but the issue was that I just would not shut up about astronomy. Even when we weren't talking about science, I just kept talking about it. So I think in despair, the teacher said, "Why don't you write a textbook for the library?" And I'm not sure if she was serious or not, but off I went. And every night came home and furiously filled up this textbook with everything we knew about astronomy.
And you gave it to the teacher?
I gave it to the school, and they put it in the library. I don't know if it's still there, but
what is handwritten textbook?
Yeah,
it
was all traced and copied from books I had at home. I wouldn't say too much of it was original research at the age of 7 or 8 or so. But yeah, it really was just this obsession that I had to get out. There was no one to talk about with or no one to interact with. There was no vent for this excitement. So actually encouraging me just to write as many pages as I wanted about it was a great way of channeling all that energy.
Were you a bit alienated in school as this kind of hyper-curious kid who kept asking questions that teachers didn't know the answer for?
Yeah, I'd say the first few years of primary school were pretty rough for me, and that I just went to the local public school in the northern beaches of Sydney, and most of the kids were just not interested in the same things as me. They didn't have this strong, interest in science and dinosaurs and space. In fifth grade, I switched schools to an opportunity class, to a selective class, and that was really transformational for me because I was actually alongside kids who were a lot like me and who had similar interests to me. And some of the kids I went to school with in fifth grade and sixth grade, I'm still friends with almost 30 years later.
Your family story is so interesting. Tell me about your grandmother.
So my father's mother, Ruth, she was born in Germany in 1917, and she had trained to be a veterinarian. She was from a reasonably well-off family, and life was going pretty well for her. But my family are Jewish, and when the Nazis came to power, obviously things turn very bad very quickly.
So she was, what, a teenager or something like that when Hitler came to power?
Yeah, so she would have been 16 when Hitler came to power. And then going to university during the years leading up to World War II. So in 1938, her father said, we need to get out of here before it's too late.
Why did he wait so long, do you think?
You know, I often ask myself what it would have been like for me, and you always say, oh, look, it's not going to get that bad. It's going to be okay. Like, you know, they'll lose an election or something. You can always tell yourself that, you know, you can get through this. And I guess, though, when people were actually being rounded up and things started to get really bad, her father made the call that they had to leave.
He was a hero of the German Reich too, wasn't he?
He'd actually fought in World War One and had received an Iron Cross for bravery in World War One. So he was, I didn't know him, but he, I've told, was very, very patriotic, proud German soldier and German businessman.
So perhaps he felt they can't possibly want to go after me.
Yeah. I mean, he was an upstanding citizen, you know, a valued member of his community. But they decided to get out any way they could. My grandmother was engaged at the time, and she and her fiance just got on the first boat they could, and they went to different places. My grandmother got on a ship to the Philippines with a bunch of farmers who basically told her that they would pretend she was one of their family, and her fiance went to what's now Belize, and they actually never saw each other again. But she made it to Australia, and eventually, a few years later, she got her parents and her brother out as well. But she arrived in Australia in 1938. She tells me the only words of English she spoke were yes, no, and bloody, which she said you can get a long way with in Australia.
Certainly can.
Her qualifications, her university degree wasn't recognised. She didn't speak English, but she said the community just took her in. Everyone just looked after her and made sure that she had a place to live and helped her. She met another German refugee in Melbourne, who ended up being my grandfather, married, had three children, many grandchildren, and ended up really being a paragon of the community, incredibly involved in community service, went back to university many years later, and just really was one of those people that holds a family together. And all that just from an immigrant who didn't speak English all those years before.
My guest in conversation is Brian Gaensler. He's a professor in astronomy. He's written a book called Extreme Cosmos about, well, the extremity of cosmic events that he's been studying all his life. Just a little more on that. You still got your grandmother's boat ticket, haven't you, that she had when she came to Australia?
You're referring to a speech I gave a number of years ago where I sort of talked about the things that to me symbolise Australia, and I said that my grandmother's boat ticket, I actually don't physically have it. I asked her for it and she wasn't able to find it. But the fact that Australia took her and many other people like her in with no questions asked, and once they got here just did everything they could to make her feel welcome and succeed. I think there's some things about Australia that hopefully haven't changed, but I think there's some lessons there about people who come to Australia just because they have nowhere else to go.
Yeah, you also discovered that there were people who weren't able to get here too in that time.
Yeah, so you like to think that Australia was a place that took in people from this horrific situation. You know, we have these discussions about whether people in Australia knew what was going on in Germany and in Europe at the time. But I went to the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., and it was quite critical of the U.S.'s attitude and the fact that the U.S. didn't really do anything. And I found myself thinking, I was reading this, well, you know, I'm Australian. I'm quite proud of the role that we played. And then the museum had a section on other countries, and there was a quote from the Australian Trade and Customs Minister, who I guess is the equivalent now of the Immigration Minister, who said something along the lines of that we don't have a Jewish problem and we don't want to create one by bringing Jews into our country.
We don't have a Jewish problem and we don't want to create one.
Right, which is firstly incredibly ignorant because there actually had been Jews on the First Fleet, and so there was already a vibrant Jewish community in Australia. But also this suggestion that I think some people still make now is that if you bring people to this country, that they will bring their problems or their fights with them. And you know, they're always quite vague about what that actually means, but this mentality that Australia is somehow this you know, island that's protected from the troubles of the rest of the world and we have to keep it that way, I think is a bit specious.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing for a minister to say in the light of, you know, Sir John Monash and his contribution to Australia in the First World War too. You specialise in supernovae, which is the plural of supernovas, isn't it? Essentially what are exploding stars. One thing I discovered from reading a book is that we get all our precious metals, we get things like gold from a supernova. How is that created in a supernova?
So we believe the universe began in a Big Bang 13.7 billion years ago. And we know from quite detailed calculations and measurements that the only elements of the periodic table that were made in the Big Bang were hydrogen, helium, and lithium. And if you just look around us or look in our bodies, there's many other elements inside us. So you have to ask, well, where did they come from? And it turns out the only way you can make heavier elements is inside stars. Stars are essentially these cosmic furnaces or forges, and the extreme heat and pressure of the very center of a star can make heavier elements. So right now our sun is mainly simply converting hydrogen into helium. But older stars that are even hotter than our sun convert helium into carbon and carbon into oxygen and oxygen into magnesium and so on. You can't populate the entire periodic table doing this. It turns out that the most stable element in the universe is iron. And so stars can make every element in the periodic table up to iron, which I think is element number 26. But there are 92 elements on the standard periodic table. So you've got to ask, well, where does gold and lead and tin come from? And the answer is that very big stars end their lives in these huge explosions, supernovae. And at the moment of the explosion, the pressure and the heat and the temperature are so catastrophically high that they actually break through this iron barrier and instantly forge all of the heavy elements in the universe. What's more,
turn base metal into gold. This is
pretty much
this is the dream of alchemy.
You have to blow up an entire star to do it, but you can turn iron into gold. And then the force of the And the two things that happen. Firstly, you make all those heavy elements. But the other key thing is that when the star explodes, it then throws all these elements out into space. It splatters them all over the place. And so many millions or billions of years later, some random interstellar cloud of gas is seeded with all of these heavy elements. And then gradually that cloud will collapse under gravity and become a star, and other parts of the cloud will become the planets. So our sun formed from some primordial gas cloud about 5 billion years ago, and our Earth congealed out of the leftovers. And so all the gold and iodine and tin and uranium in rocks, in buildings, and in our bodies was actually the leftover dust from a star that died billions of years ago.
That's so lovely. That's a beautiful thought, isn't it? I mean, it's often said that humans, we're all stardust.
Yeah, every atom in every person who's ever lived was at one point inside some long-dead star.
When a star explodes in our night sky, if it were to do so, what would it look like?
Well, a big star just exploded a couple of weeks ago, and it looks like nothing with your naked eye, but you have to look at it with a telescope and you can see a pinpoint of light that wasn't there the night before. But the really exciting thing is when a supernova happens in our own Milky Way galaxy. And when that happens and it's nearby, you know about it. The last time we saw this was in 1604, so a very long time ago. But when this happened, these things are so bright, you can easily see them with your naked eye. You can see them sometimes during the daylight. And there was one, a whopper, that happened in the year 1006 that was so bright that you could actually read by it at night. It actually cast a shadow. It was so bright.
How long would that last for? Like for a whole season or something, or a day or an hour?
A few months, slowly fading away. It brightens over a few days and then gradually fades over a period of months.
That must have been seen as a huge portent coming in, 1,000 years after the birth of Christ in its time. It must have been seen as weird by the historical record.
So firstly, I should say it's amazing that we have these historical records, because we would love to know what our favourite star or galaxy was doing 1,000 years ago, but we don't have detailed records of most things in astronomy from that long ago. But when these things happened, people wrote them down. And particularly the Chinese community had very skilled astronomers who wrote down incredible details about the date it happened, how bright it was, where it was in the sky, and pretty much all the same things we would measure now. And, of course, different communities interpreted these things in different ways. The name supernova, the word nova is Latin for new. And so people thought this was a new star being born, quite the opposite from what we know now, a star dying. They thought it was a star appearing. The Chinese called them guest stars, and they interpreted these as omens. There was one time where a Chinese general was debating as to whether to go to war, and they saw this supernova go off, and they saw that as an indication that they should attack some other group, and a lot of people were killed simply because of this supernova.
Some indifferent star somewhere in the galaxy going off. So how long has it been since we've had one in our neighbourhood? 1,000 years ago?
So it's really, really frustrating. So we had a supernova in 1576 that was very bright. Then we had one in 1604, so only 28 years later. The telescope was invented in 1608, so I'm sure people were thinking, great, once the next one goes off, we can finally figure out what these things are.
Roll over it then.
Yep, yeah. And we haven't had one since. So we think that on average, a galaxy like the Milky Way has a supernova about every 50 years. So either we're spectacularly overdue, or there are supernovae going off in our Milky Way, but they're hidden by dark dust clouds so that we can't see them.
Do we have any technology that can give us an early warning of when one might happen in our neighbourhood?
Yes. Firstly, we think we know enough about how stars evolve that if there is a star about to go, that we can certainly point it and say that one's going soon. When I say that, I mean that we can probably say it's going to go in about 100 years. Our forecasting isn't more precise than that. But one of the really interesting things is that the star, the explosion actually happens from the inside out. So it's actually the inside of the star that explodes. And then it takes about an hour for the explosion to work its way out to the surface. So for the first hour, the star looks completely normal. But you can actually, there is a way to actually tell that the star, the inside of the star has exploded, because when the inside of the star begins exploding, it releases this massive volley of these ghostly subatomic particles called neutrinos. And we do have neutrino detectors on Earth, and they run all the time, 24 hours a day. And so we would actually get about 1 hour's warning if a supernova exploded. You'd get the neutrinos first, and you know that in about an hour, some star was about to become extremely bright.
Are you on neutrino watch yourself? So at any given moment, you can down tools, drop what you're doing, and rush to a telescope?
I am not, but there is some sort of neutrino network of people around the world who have their pagers or their beepers ready to go. An hour's warning isn't much. It would be hard to even tell which direction it was coming from. But you could imagine some email alert going out warning people that in about an hour, something really special is about to occur.
CC me on that email, please. I want to know about it. Professor Brian Gaensler is my guest in conversation from the University of Sydney. His book is called Extreme Cosmos. You went looking for remnants of a supernova that we might have missed, and you sort of found one. Tell me about that detective trail, Brian.
So as I said, we haven't seen a supernova in our own galaxy since 1604, but we think they happen every 50 years. So the presumption is that there's probably dozens of these things that have happened the last 1,000 years that we missed. Even if we've missed it, we can still pick up the pieces afterwards, because the outer layers of the star are blown out into space at very high speed. If you come back later, you see this expanding, glowing smoke ring or bubble that we call a supernova remnant. So even if you've missed the explosion, you can go looking for these clouds of debris and say that must have been from an exploded star. So I started going back through weird objects that around the Milky Way that people had sort of said, well, I don't know what that is, and put it in the too hard basket. And we found one object that had basically been suggested it was a young supernova remnant, a recent explosion. But then somebody else said maybe not, and it sort of got dropped from all the catalogues and essentially forgotten about. No one had even wondered what this object was for 20 years. And we went back to it and looked at it in more detail with new telescopes and discovered that this was actually a bona fide remnant of a supernova explosion that probably happened about 1,000 years ago. And it's extremely bright and extremely luminous, this glowing, expanding smoke ring, but had been completely overlooked by the community. And so we've now added it back into the catalogue, and it's a really nice example of the forensics of what happens after a star dies.
Brian, one of the things I enjoyed most from your book is I really came to understand, in layman's terms, how a star dies and becomes a supernova. It's a really amazing process. It's one of the most extraordinary things that happens anywhere in the universe, and you sort of go through it bit by bit, this spectacular. We can imagine our own sun doing this, but let's go bigger, because our own sun's not going to go supernova, is it?
Now, our sun's are quite a puny star.
Don't say puny.
Well, the technical term for our sun is a dwarf. Quite a small star, and it will die.
Sounds like shrinkage when you put it like that.
It will die and it won't be good, but it won't explode.
It won't explode. So in order to look at a supernova, we have to look at a much bigger star than the one that is our sun. First of all, how does it actually... we have to begin with the way it generates energy, don't we, when we talk about how it's going to die?
Right. So the reason why the sun and all other stars are the same every day, why our sun isn't changing from day to day, is because there's this very delicate balancing act. The sun is a giant ball of gas, and it has gravity, and the gravity is continually trying to drag all of that gas down to the centre and make it collapse. But the sun is very hot, and that produces pressure. And that pressure, just like the hot air in a balloon makes it expand, that hot air is pushing the sun out. So you've got this never-ending tug-of-war between heat pushing out and gravity pulling in.
And that's equilibrium, is it? That's a kind of equilibrium.
Hydrostatic equilibrium is the technical term, yeah.
Okay.
And most stars just are in, happily in that equilibrium for millions or billions of years.
So it's creating energy by burning hydrogen being created, turned into helium. Is it burning? Or how do you describe that process? It's nuclear fusion of a kind, isn't
it? Yeah, we use the word burning, but it's not really burning. It's nuclear fusion, the same reaction that happens in a hydrogen bomb. Basically, if you take two hydrogen atoms and you bang them together, just like taking two billiard balls and smashing them together, sometimes they'll stick and form helium and some heat will be given off. The amount of heat is really, really minuscule. But if you do this trillions and trillions of times every second, then you get this burning ball of fury, which is the sun.
So our sun really has this layer of hydrogen that's being burnt away, to use that bad phrase again, and turned it and pushed and turned into helium. This is alchemy again, isn't it? It's going from the top of the periodic table to the second
right.
position down.
Yeah, so that's actually happening in the core. Most of the sun is just sort of bubbling and swirling around, but the core is very, very hot, millions of degrees, and the hydrogen in the core of the sun is being converted into helium at some incredible rate.
And that's happening day in, day out in a really, really stable event at the moment because our sun's in its middle phase or something like that.
Millions of tons every second is being converted from hydrogen to helium, but there's so much of this hydrogen that the sun just does its thing and doesn't change.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio and the World Wide Web.
Astronomer Professor Brian Gaensler is my guest. His book is called Extreme Cosmos, and I'm getting him to explain to me what happens when a star like our sun, well, bigger than our sun, in fact, dies when it gets to the final stages of its life. So normally through the normal life of a star, it's burning, it's turning hydrogen into helium, energy is released, and that's how we get all that heat and light from it. What happens as a star gets towards the end of its life and it's burnt away all of that hydrogen, Brian?
So this phase where a star is burning hydrogen and turning into helium lasts for a very long time. But once all that hydrogen's exhausted, the star's things pick up and the next few phases of the star's life start to happen faster and faster. So once the hydrogen's all used up, you've got a lot of helium. Helium will burn in the same way that hydrogen will burn, but it needs to be much hotter. And so eventually what will happen is that now that the star isn't burning hydrogen anymore, that balance that I mentioned between heat and gravity is broken, and you've only got gravity. So the star starts to shrink, but as you squeeze it, it heats up, and eventually it heats up so much that the helium can now fuse, helium atoms can stick together, and they make carbon. In the same way that hydrogen sticks together to make helium, helium sticks together to make carbon, and you now have more heat and more light being put out, and the star stops shrinking and returns to a new phase of equilibrium.
So there's this extra pressure, and all those helium atoms then start travelling up the periodic table, in other words, and they become more and more complex bigger, I suppose, rather than more complex.
Right, heavier, bigger, yeah. And so now you've got sort of a second wind, if you like. The star is now similar to what it was before, but doesn't look that different, but it's now burning helium as its fuel source instead of hydrogen and turning into carbon instead of turning into helium. So the star thinks, okay, I'm good again now, everything's fine, but it's living on borrowed time because the helium will eventually be used up and you'll be left with carbon. And then the process will happen again. The star will start shrinking and the carbon will get squeezed until it starts burning and fuses to form oxygen. And this process just keeps happening over and over again. It uses up its fuel, it squeezes, and then whatever ashes are left from the last round becomes the fuel for the next round. And this keeps happening each sequence after the next until you get a star that's a bit like a Matryoshka doll with hydrogen on the outside and then helium and then carbon and then oxygen and all these onion layers working all their way down to the core where you have iron.
Iron at the core of a sun, a core of a star.
Right, right. So you do this fusion of elements into heavier elements into heavier elements until you hit iron. But the catch is that iron is a very stable element. And even if you squeeze it and heat it up, it doesn't easily fuse to make even heavier elements. So the end of this sequence of successive burning of heavier elements arrives when this iron core starts at the center and just begins to grow as more and more of the star turns into iron.
So what happens then now that you've got this growing iron ball in the middle of your star, Brian?
So this ball of iron will grow until it's about 1.5 times the mass of the sun. And at that point, the individual...
Well, you mean our sun.
Our sun.
Yeah.
So our sun is sort of 2,000 trillion trillion tons. And so when this ball of iron gets to about 3,000 trillion trillion tons, you now reach this catastrophic point where the individual iron atoms or nuclei are touching each other, and they can the actual force of the atoms being pushed against each other can no longer withstand the force of gravity, which is trying to squeeze everything down. So eventually, you know, so the straw that breaks the camel's back, when one too many iron atoms form, the entire core catastrophically collapses down till it's only about 25 kilometres across.
How? How does it collapse? If it can't be collapsed any further, how does it collapse?
It cheats. Iron atoms can't be pushed together any more closely. So what it does is atoms are made of electrons and protons and neutrons. An electron is negatively charged and a proton is positively charged. So what happens is the electrons and the protons actually merge together and combine. This is a process called neutronization, because the electron, which is negative, and the proton, which is positive, merge together and become neutrons.
Is that a weird event?
It's a very strange event. And people had suggested theoretically that this could happen, but no one really believed that it could happen until we actually saw these stars doing this.
So once iron has then been compressed beyond all compression to eventually become part of some weird, weird physical event, what happens then?
So you've got this core that might have been many thousands of kilometres across, this big ball of iron. In a fraction of a second, it suddenly shrunk till it's only 25 kilometres across. So you've really, essentially, it's like taking a building and just making the foundations of the building disappear. You've taken the core of the star that's holding up everything else around it and just made it shrink to some tiny size.
Like to the size of Newcastle or something like that, essentially.
Yeah, pretty much. And so the rest of the star says, hang on, there's nothing. A bit like, you know, those cartoons where Wile E. Coyote sort of runs out off the cliff and suddenly realizes that there's nothing holding him up anymore. The outer layers of the star sort of say, uh-oh, and they all start falling towards the center. The catch is that this new star that's only 25 kilometers across, this neutron star, the core of what was this old star, the surface of a neutron star is trillions of times stronger than steel. So when the outer layers of the star fall down and they hit the surface of this neutron star, they essentially rebound catastrophically. And it's actually that rebound that blows the star apart.
And it just blows all that, what those remnants of hydrogen, helium, right out and dust out into space.
Yeah.
How long does that process take?
So it takes about an hour.
An hour?
It takes about...
It's been living for billions and billions of years, and all this happens in an hour.
Oh, yeah, it's pretty amazingly fast, given you've got to remember, this star is now millions and millions of kilometres across. It only takes an hour for this shockwave, this sonic boom that's occurred when the outer layers smash into this neutron star. It takes about an hour for that sonic boom to work its way out through the star and to rip the star apart.
So what's left then? You've got this cloud of dust and all bits of rubbish around the end of it, and that's like a spherical sort of cloud of some kind?
So you've got this sort of spherical bubble or smoke ring, which is now very radioactive because, as I mentioned earlier, the incredible heat of the explosion actually forges all of these new elements. So you've now got all these nasty things like radioactive titanium and uranium and plutonium in this glowing radioactive debris cloud. But at the core, you now have this newborn new type of star, this neutron star, this object that's only 25 kilometers across, but which weighs 3,000 trillion trillion tons. So these are probably the densest objects in the universe. You've taken something that weighs more than the sun and you've compressed it down till it's the size of a small city.
So if I were to get a teaspoonful of neutron star, any equivalence to how is anything you can make draw equivalence to? How heavy would that be?
Yeah, so if you walked up to a neutron star with a teaspoon, I should say that would be a very bad idea.
Yeah, it would be a real bad idea.
But if you did, the amount of neutron star material in your teaspoon would weigh about the same as 10,000 Sydney Harbour Bridges.
That's heavy. That's seriously heavy there. What is this neutron star made of in the centre there? Is this densely compressed iron you're talking about?
No, it's basically just individual neutrons touching each other. So you've taken the neutrons out of the cores of atoms and just touched them together like a bunch of marbles in a jar. Now, there are still a few electrons and protons sort of floating around like sort of, you know, lost pets, but vast majority of the neutron star is just neutrons touching each other. Oh. And it's the individual neutrons pushing against each other, which is holding the star up against gravity. It's still got gravity and it's still being tried to pull towards the center, but it's now individual neutrons being squeezed against each other, which is stopping that happening.
In this ball that is the girth of the size of the city of Newcastle, thereabouts. Now we can start get things down to a human scale again.
Right.
So this is kind of cool, isn't it? And then it starts to spin, doesn't it, Brian?
So we believe that stars are all rotating. The Earth is rotating once every 24 hours. The sun rotates about once a month. But you have this effect which physicists call conservation of angular momentum, but which much more simply is the effect you see when you watch an ice skater and they spin around, and as they pull their arms in, they spin faster. So it turns out that the smaller you are, the faster you have to spin. So if you start with something that's quite a large object and you collapse it down, as has happened at the core of the star, then whatever gentle spin that it had before it collapsed is now incredibly amplified, and you get an object that rotates incredibly quickly. And we haven't yet seen a neutron star right after the supernova explosion that formed it. But our guess is that these things could be spinning maybe 100 to 500 times every second. So they're almost as fast as a kitchen blender.
Something that big too. How do they then sometimes become pulsars? Pulsars being these great winking things in the sky.
So these stars, for the same reason that they spin up faster as they collapse, they also become much more magnetic. If you take any sort of magnet and you shrink it down, it actually makes the magnet stronger. Now, we know the sun is magnetic. That's what creates sunspots and solar flares and all of that. But if you shrink such an object down till it's only 25 kilometers across, you now have a magnet which is a trillion times stronger than the Earth's. And very strange things happen under such intense magnetic fields. And one of them that we don't entirely understand is that the star actually shoots out these very intense beams of light and radiation along its magnetic poles. So if the star is spinning, and if its magnetic poles and its rotation poles don't line up, then you get this lighthouse effect, this beam of radiation that sweeps across the sky. And if you just happen to be in the line of this lighthouse, then you see the pulsar look like it's turning on and then turning off again once per rotation. So we see thousands of these things all over the sky, these spinning dead stars. And because of this pulsar effect, we can actually measure how fast they're spinning to ridiculous precision.
The way you describe it, it makes the pulsar sound like an accident light that's there after the scene of an accident, which is kind of what's happened, isn't it, really?
I hadn't thought of it that way, no. But yeah, it's some sort of beacon saying a supernova was here.
Yeah, just going beep, 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 beep at impossibly fast speeds. Brian, you're an expert in dying stars. Our sun is too small, as you said before, to go supernova. Explain what will happen to our solar system when our sun does die, though.
Okay, so firstly I should preface that the magic number we think for a star to go supernova is that it has to begin its life about 8 times the mass of the sun. So even if you're 5 times the mass of the sun, which would be a very big star, you're still not big enough to go supernova. Our sun is quite puny. It's quite a small star by astronomical standards. And so it doesn't have enough mass or enough heat to cascade through this series of elements on the periodic table. It can convert hydrogen to helium, and maybe it will convert its helium into carbon, but it probably won't go much further than that. And once it starts to run out of fuel, a bit like a car running out of petrol, it will start to hiccup. And one of the things that will happen is that as the sun starts to run out of fuel, it will swell up and become very, very large. It will become 1,000 times larger than the size it is now.
And it will also 1,000 times larger?
Yes, and this is bad. This is very, very bad. Because what will happen is the sun will become so large that its size will envelop the orbits of Mercury, Venus, Earth, and probably Mars. So if we're still here about 5 billion years from now when this happens, that would be a good time to move. Because as the sun swells up and the temperature of the Earth goes up, at first the atmosphere would boil away, the oceans would evaporate, and eventually the whole planet would just get melted down to a big lump of slag.
Lump of slag.
Well, the Earth is basically a big ball of iron, and it would just melt and then eventually vaporize as the sun enveloped it.
Yeah, would the force of it just explode the Earth and sort of spray out a whole lot of dust that was the iron-like dust that was the planet out into the...
It's a very gradual process, this conversion of the sun into what we call a red giant. Because this star is very big, it also cools down. The sun will cool down by a factor of 2 or 3, so it will change from its sort of yellowy colour now to sort of a dim red colour. It's a very slow process lasting thousands of years. So it's not that this Earth would be exploded or swept away. It just gradually would melt down and then get swallowed and just become mixed in with the other material inside the sun.
That's so sad. It seems so sad when you put it like that. We don't need to pack our bags just yet for that, though, do we?
Right, so we've got about 5 billion years. Okay. The sun is only halfway through its life. If the sun was a person, it'd be about 40 years old. So we've still got many good, fruitful years ahead of us before we have to worry about the sun changing in any serious way.
Professor Brian Gansler is here, an expert in dying stars and many, many large and extreme events that happen in the night sky. His book is called Extreme Cosmos. You write about the patches of dark that are in the night sky. Sometimes there are patches there. You look up in the middle of in the middle of a paddock somewhere in the middle of the country, but there will still be patches of dark. What are those patches of dark?
So you can't really see these from the city, but if you can get out to the country, there are these inky spots where there are stars missing, and one of the most famous ones is a patch just to the side of the Southern Cross called the Coalsack. People used to think this was a place where all the stars had died or moved away, a hole.
A graveyard.
Yeah. But we now know it's sort of the opposite. It's actually a big cloud of gunk, of dirt, dust, dense material that's actually completely blocking out all the light from behind. So it's sort of a piece of gaffer tape on the sky, if you like, that's blocking out everything underneath it. And the galaxy is full of these things. In fact, the center of our galaxy is an incredibly spectacular, dazzling place that would be the brightest thing in the night sky, except for the fact that there's so many of these dark clouds between us and the center of our galaxy that you just can't see any of that action through naked eye or through a simple telescope.
So are these dark nebulas more remnants of exploded stars?
They're the descendants of these exploded stars. So eventually, when a star explodes, the debris fly outwards at high speed, but many millions of years later, that debris has slowed down and cooled down and congealed to become some passive, quiet, dark, dense cloud.
What would happen if one just wandered over into our solar system and if we were to drift into one of these vastly huge dark nebulae?
So if the sun were embedded inside one of these dark clouds, it wouldn't be dangerous in any way. It wouldn't affect the light from the sun or our climate, I don't think. But it would have a very sad effect on astronomy in that these clouds are so opaque and so dark that if we were sitting inside such a cloud, the brightest star in the night sky, Sirius, which you can easily see with your naked eye from just about anywhere in the world, even Sirius would be so dim that you would need the Hubble Space Telescope to just see it at the limit of the Hubble's capabilities. So if we were in such a cloud, other than the planets and the moon and the sun, the sky would be completely, utterly black. And you have to question whether anyone would ever have gotten interested in the astronomy in the first place, because there would be no stars to see and to wonder about.
That's an amazing thought, isn't it? Imagine if intelligent life arose on the Earth and the only thing we could see in the sky would be the sun and the moon. Would we see other planets?
Yeah, the other planets would be
So there'd just be a couple of dots.
Yeah.
There'd be the other planets, the sun and the moon. And that's all we'd known. And then after a period of however many years or something, the dark nebula went on its merry way and opened the night sky to the human race. That would be a profound moment, wouldn't it?
There's great science fiction stories that sort of propose ideas like this. Stories where the sky is always bright or always dark and no one can see the stars. And when the stars come out for the first time, everyone goes mad. They just never seen it before and they think it's the end of the world.
The whole question of time becomes interesting too, because if we were to see a star go supernova on us in the sky, the truth is, what we'd be witnessing would be an event that would have happened, I don't know, 1,000 years ago in our time. It almost begs the question of, what does now mean anyway, when it takes so long for the light from a distant cosmic event to reach us, Brian?
Yeah, so what you're referring to is the fact that light travels at a finite speed. Light travels at about 300,000 kilometres a second. So when you flick the light switch on, you don't see light travelling from the light globe to your eye because it's so fast. But when you're dealing with the universe, the distances are so large that you have to take into account the fact that it actually takes light time to get from one place to another. So if an object is, say, well, we use that speed of light as a measure of distance. So if we say that an object is 1,000 light years away, what we mean is that even at the speed of light, it takes you 1,000 years to get to us. But that also means that if you're looking at that object in 2011 and you see it explode, it didn't actually explode in 2011. It actually exploded in the year 1011. But the light has taken 1,000 years to get to us. So whenever astronomers are looking at objects, we always have to factor into account this delay, that you really aren't seeing things now. You're seeing them as they were some time ago. And that's something you have to remember, but it's also very helpful because it means the sky is a time machine. If we want to see what the universe looked like 10 billion years ago, we don't have to invent a time machine. We just find very distant galaxies that are 10 billion light years away, and we see how they looked a long time ago, because the light from that time is just getting to us now.
Yeah, that does my head in, because it means that it seems like it's happening now, but in fact it happened, at the dawn of time, and that's incredibly strange. Like I say, I don't know what now means anymore when you think on that scale. You write that many suns, stars, are bigger and stranger, much, much bigger than stranger than ours. Tell me about a star called Mira.
So Myra is a very famous star that was discovered hundreds of years ago. And it's a very unusual star because it changes its brightness. Now, lots of stars change their brightness, but what's unusual about Myra is it does it in a very regular way. Every 11 months, and it's been doing this for centuries, it gets very bright, and then it gets so faint that you can't see it with your naked eye anymore, and then it returns and gets bright again, and then it fades again.
Over how long a period of time will it go through this cycle?
Well, it does it every 11 months, and it will keep maintaining the cycle probably for thousands of years.
How can a star do that? I mean, they're consistent, aren't they? They don't just wink on and off, do they? How does that happen?
So this star is dying. It's essentially the sun, but at a very advanced age. And I mentioned earlier that when the sun begins to run out of fuel, it will sort of hiccup. And this is sort of what's happening to Myra. It's reached this period in its life where it's become very unstable, where the balance between gravity pulling in and heat pushing out is breaking down. And so as it's desperately trying to restore that balance, it starts shrinking and expanding every 11 months. And every time it shrinks, it gets bright. And every time it expands, it fades away. And so it will keep doing this for many thousands of years, but it's moving into a very sort of terminal end of its life where it's beginning to lose control of its ability to hold itself together.
What is the largest structure in the universe that we know of, Brian?
So the largest thing that we've ever found is something called the Sloan Great Wall. Sloan because it was discovered in a project called the Sloan Survey, and Great Wall because what it appears to be, it looks like just a giant wall of galaxies. So instead of the galaxies just sort of being sprinkled randomly like grains of rice on black paper, galaxies appear to be arranged in special patterns. And this is one particular place in the sky where the galaxies are arranged in this long string or wall that's 1.4 billion light years across. So this thing is massive. It's a significant fraction of the entire length of the universe, this long sort of chain of galaxies.
When you say chain of galaxies, are you talking about 100 galaxies or a lot more than that?
Hundreds of thousands or millions of galaxies. So in each galaxy, of course, is half a trillion stars, each with its own planets. But all of these galaxies are carefully arranged by gravity into this incredibly long sheet that's just stretching across the entire sky.
Is that like a car accident of galaxies, in other words? Are they all colliding into one another, overlapping each other, scribbling all over each other's structure as they form this great wall?
No, we actually do have car crashes in the universe where galaxies actually smash into each other. But these galaxies aren't particularly bunched together. It's not like they're all jammed up against each other. But they are sort of loosely grouped into this long sheet.
There is sound in space. That's another thing I discovered from your book. You know, there's that famous scene in 2001 where it's the only movie I'm aware of where space is actually truly silent, as it would be to the ears of an astronaut. But there is sound in space. Where does the deepest note in space come from, Brian?
So the reason why there's sound in space is because space isn't actually a vacuum. It's incredibly low density, but there is gas in space, and that gas can transmit sound waves. So it turns out the universe is full of noises, but they're noises that we can't hear with our ears because they're too deep. And so there is this very distant black hole, this giant sort of collapsed core at the center of a galaxy, which is shooting out these very powerful jets into the gas around it, and that's driving this throbbing deep note that is 50. It's a B, and it's 56 octaves below middle C. So you'd have to add about another 600 or 700 keys to the left-hand side of your piano to be able to play a note as deep as the note that this black hole is making as it's drumming against all the gas surrounding it.
Is it pounding it, or is it just a single sustained note?
It's just a single sustained note, and it's holding that note for millions of years.
Is it making things around it shimmer?
It's making all the gas around it oscillate in the same way that if you sing a note, it will make a glass vibrate or even shatter. It's making all the gas around it get hotter and colder and hotter and colder as it throbs this note for thousands of light years in all directions.
We can't possibly hear that. That's well outside of our ability to hear anything at all.
We can't hear it, but we can see it. In the same way that you can see someone sprinkles salt on the table and then bangs the table very hard, you can see the salt jiggling around. We can see the gas in this distant galaxy jiggling around, even though we can't actually hear the sound that it's making.
You've been in this for, several decades now as an astronomer. Are there things you long to observe, things that you haven't seen that you long to observe?
Well, I think every astronomer who studies exploding stars, supernovas, is longing for this long-awaited supernova in our Milky Way. The last time we had a supernova you could see in our Milky Way that you could see during the daytime was in 1604, and I think we could all pretty much fill the rest of our careers with exciting new studies and measurements if the next one would happen soon.
And at the moment, I should say earlier this year we spoke to the WA chief scientist Lynn Beasley, who was talking about the Square Kilometre Array, the bid to bring that to Australia. How's that bid going, as far as you understand?
Well, so this is a proposal to build a multi-billion dollar telescope that will be hundreds of times more powerful than anything we've ever built before. And I've been involved in the Square Kilometre Array for almost 20 years, but we're finally nearing the business end of things. There are two competing groups trying to get the Square Kilometre Array built in their country, an African group led by South Africa, and an Australia and New Zealand consortium, and we submit our bid documents to the international consortium next month in September, and then the decision we think will be announced in February of 2012. So we're getting very, very close now to finding out whether Australia and New Zealand will be the host for the most complicated instrument ever conceived.
And what will that allow you to do if indeed it does come to Australia?
Well, the things we can think of are probably only the tip of the iceberg, but we want to see the first stars born. We want to understand what's the dark energy that dominates what the universe is made of. We want to see Earth-like planets form around other stars. We want to maybe even detect intelligent signals from other civilizations. The list of what you could do with this telescope is just spectacular.
Brian, great to meet you, and fantastic to hear you explain what it's like for a star to die for us today. Thank you so much for being my guest in Conversations today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.